Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Sean Molloy, who is Reader in International Relations at the University of Kent, about his new book, Kant's International Relations, The Political Theology of Perpetual Peace. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave.
So this is an incredibly fascinating book about not just actually kind of international relations theory, but a really detailed engagement with Kant, which has lots of different implications far and beyond politics and IR. But I suppose the kind of the place to start with it is really what kind of interested you or what kind of, you know, gave you the sort of desire to write this book. Where does it fit in with your sort of broader intellectual activities?
I started the book out of curiosity because I'd read a little bit about Kant years ago when I was doing my master's and PhD in international relations. And there was a very established set of principles about how you read Kant in terms of democratic peace theory, cosmopolitanism, etc. And I began to read Toward Perpetual Peace more carefully around about 2006. And I started to notice, and this is something I noticed before, but it really started to get my attention around about then, that Kant kept making these peculiar references to providence and other religious concepts and theological concepts and metaphysical concepts and ideas in his political works. And this was something that was very rarely, if ever, addressed in IR literature. Why is he constantly invoking providence? Insofar as it was ever dealt with, it was dealt with in terms of, oh, well, he just means this in either synonymous with the nature or synonymous with some kind of idea that isn't to be taken literally or seriously. And I began thinking, well, hold on, these concepts and ideas, particularly ideas, are used to shore up an awful lot of problematic elements, at least problematic from our contemporary perspective elements of Kant's project. So I thought, I think this needs a bit more investigation than had been dedicated to it at that point. That's what got me started.
You mentioned actually two really important ideas that will, I guess, kind of introduce the book, but also show its importance specifically for international relations theorists, but also actually at the same time drawing a wider audience, I think. And these are ideas about cosmopolitanism and then democratic peace theory. You mentioned them already, and I wonder if you could kind of like unpack them a bit for me, just in terms of setting out what they are, because obviously Kant is really crucial, particularly, this is the stuff I know kind of, you know, better, particularly to ideas about cosmopolitanism. But in turn, those two sets of ideas are really important for international relations.
Yeah, they're kind of key aspects of sort of liberal approaches to international politics over the last 20, 30 years. The first, democratic peace theory, is this principle that democratic states generally will not fight wars with each other, which has been elevated to a sort of rule of international relations. There's no instance that democratic peace theorists claim of democracies fighting each other. Right? They'll fight other states, non-democratic states, and they'll fight colonial wars, but they will generally, the general rule according to democratic peace theory is that democracies will not fight each other, which at least has the advantage or positive element of clarity, whereas cosmopolitanism is a much more amorphous set of ideas revolving around the idea of world citizenship and the idea that we exist in a global political space and we should think in global political terms. And they see in Kant, both sets of theorists see in Kant a sort of intellectual forefather and source almost of legitimacy. And they find in Toward Perpetual Peace this idea that democracies, as far as they're concerned, are inherently peaceful in their relations with each other.
The final thing, I think, in terms of both our cosmopolitanism and democratic peace theory ideas, is I guess that thing you mentioned about, if not misreadings, but people kind of, you know, possibly ignoring things Kant has actually said. And one really obvious way to kind of set that up is this question about the texts themselves. Yep. So you mentioned Towards Perpetual Peace, and there's a couple of other kind of key texts as well. But I wonder if you could kind of introduce that text for the audience, because obviously it's crucial. And it strikes me throughout the book, even as you expand into various other things Kant has written, that what is in the text is really, you know, important to your project in this book.
Yeah, well, it's a pamphlet, a small book he wrote first in 1795 and then slightly revised it in 1796. And what he's trying to do there, I try to establish, is really bring to a head all his writings about politics, morality, ethics, etc., into one final setting, which is designed to address A, the preconditions for peace. That's the preliminary articles. How do we get to a point in principle where peace is possible? And then in the definitive articles, which he examines in the second part of the pamphlet, what that peace would look like, how that peace would be maintained, what kind of political structures are necessary. So what he's trying to do is saying, well, okay, how do we think forwards from where we are or where we appear to be in terms of our political condition, which is based in conflict and war, to a point where we can legislate a peaceful solution to international politics. And it's a very fascinating exercise because it really accepts an awful lot of negative aspects of human anthropology, which he has explored for the previous 40 years in his lectures, but also brings in this idea of teleology, how do we get to the end point that we want to achieve? And what he tries to do is he tries to marry nature, human nature, and human reason to accomplish this end. But the intriguing thing for me is he insists in a later part of the pamphlet that this has to be underwritten by belief in providence. Human ingenuity and the mechanism of nature will produce a form of peace, but not the definitive form of peace that he's looking for. But he has this idea that we have to underpin this with a belief in something greater than mankind, something greater than nature, which he finds in the idea of providence. This idea that nature isn't simply a mechanism, but that there is a purpose behind nature. And that purpose is basically the reorientation of mankind from the mechanism of nature to this idea that it is the end of nature to step outside that mechanism.
You mentioned there actually, you know, the importance of Kant's wider work, the 40 years before Towards Perpetual Peace, but then also you've gestured towards several of the kind of key ideas that the book interrogates. And maybe we'll do the latter first in terms of some of the distinctions, I think, that you've got in there. And I suppose, you know, two of them that kind of stood out to me were distinctions between kind of humanity broadly conceived as, you know, being, you know, kind of, I suppose, a good thing, you know, perfectible in terms of, you know, having, as you say, you know, kind of maybe a teleology, and then human beings as being, you know, kind of everyday, imperfect, you know, annoying kind of characters who you know, get stuff wrong and make mistakes and things. And then a parallel distinction between things that are, you know, holy and unholy. And we'll come on to talk about, you know, ideas about God a bit later on. But I wonder if you could say a bit actually about, you know, those important distinctions that come from Kant's wider work, but, you know, are really crucial to understanding what the book is talking about.
One of the things I make in the book is an important distinction in terms of how Kant deals with mankind. How does he cope with this problem of mankind not operating according to rational and moral ideas that are, as far as he's concerned, legislative, right? Why do we not appear to be rational and moral? So what he does is he introduces this perspectival distinction. He says we can view ourselves either in terms of a collection of human beings, and he says if we do this, we use our faculties of the understanding and also what he calls technical practical reason, and we can make a fairly comprehensive account of what human beings are or appear to be according to this way of thinking about mankind, right? So that's one perspective, and that certainly explains the historical record and contemporary politics. And politics, as far as he's concerned, as it will persist in the future until we reach the limits of that politics. And that's something he addresses in Toward Perpetual Peace. He says eventually we'll get to the point where wars will become so destructive that we will be faced with a choice. We'll either go down the route of universal destruction, or we will change the very foundations of our sense of ourselves, our political behavior, etc. But for the short to medium term, we're stuck within what he calls this mechanism of nature, which is understood primarily through one way of thinking about the world, which is dependent upon these faculties. But he would argue perhaps more fundamentally, there's another perspective that we can have on mankind, which is the perspective of humanity. And he says, from this perspective, we don't look at the historical record, we don't look at how human beings appear to be in their relations to each other. We look at what reason says mankind ought to be according to reason and according to what he calls rational morality. And he says this is the more fundamental aspect of what mankind ought to be. And it's a question of orientation and reorientation. How do we reorient human society from the competition of human beings towards the situation where a legislative, rational morality informs how we live? And that's the key task that he sets himself in his work, right? From the Second Critique and the Groundwork for Any Future Metaphysics of Morals, all the way through to War Perpetual Peace. And afterwards, he's trying to, if you like, affect this revolution in orientation of mankind. How can we change our fundamental set of beliefs about ourselves?
That comes through actually over and over again in the book. I'm thinking about chapter three, you know, and there's a distinction between, you know, kind of moral politicians and practical men. And I think we'll come on to talk about that. I wonder, though, before that, could you situate that kind of set of distinctions in terms of Kant's wider work? You know, the second chapter deals with, you know, the sorts of texts, but also the kinds of themes from Kant that, you know, should be reasonably familiar to anyone who's interested in philosophy more generally. So, you know, things like Critique of the Power of Judgment, questions about beauty, the sublime, these kind of, you know, broad Kantian themes. Where do they kind of figure in framing the distinction you've outlined before we kind of turn to the more sort of specific questions about politics and IR?
Yeah, well, the issue for Kant is he's trying to, I think, restore a certain sense of stability to metaphysics and philosophy after Hume. And after the effects of what he calls the destructive nomads who burn the ground of the established, he's very concerned to sort of refound Western thought. And he does this in the first critique and the second critique. But oddly and interestingly, he doesn't just do it in the kind of major works. All his works tend to be consistent and consonant with the critiques. So we have to kind of really get to grips with the critiques before we can understand what he's trying to accomplish in his political work. And I think of the three critiques, the one that sets the real agenda, apart from this kind of fundamental distinction between human beings and humanity, which is established in the second critique and in the groundwork, is the third critique, where he's thinking, well, okay, we basically have two ways of thinking about existence. Either existence is a sort of meaningless mechanism that just repeats itself without any sort of purpose, and human beings are part of this mechanism, and we just accept that, which is an appalling vista, if you like, for Kant. Or we embrace the idea that nature is purposive. And if nature is purposive, then we can start thinking about it by analogy with art. Right? So that the universe and man's place within that universe is understandable in terms of a sort of artistic product, and with the divine being the artist, and the human being and mankind in and humanity, and the transition from human beings to humanity, or at least the approximation thereof, it would be the artistic product then, right? So the third critique sets the agenda for toward perpetual peace, because it really gets to grips in a systematic way with the idea of teleology, the idea that there is an end to nature, that it's not just a purposeless, chance-driven set of contingencies without meaning. And this idea of meaning, that existence has to have some kind of meaning, and human existence has to be at the center of this quest for meaning, really dominates Kant's writings from this point onwards. In the third critique, it's kind of present in a vague way in his earlier works, and it's also present, funnily enough, in one of his important early political works, which is The Idea for Universal History, which anticipates some of the themes of the third critique. So these kind of projects are interpenetrating each other: the political project and the critical project. Sometimes people like to treat them differently, but I see them as part of a whole. And so this third critique is so important because it says, okay, there has to be a purpose, or there ought to be a purpose, or we must think that there is a purpose, because if we don't believe there's a purpose, then we can't access what that purpose might be, if that makes sense.
I mean, the logical question that comes from this is, what does this mean for IR? And one of the things you do in chapter three is this kind of formally return to politics and IR by framing it as I guess, you know, kind of Kant's problem for politics and IR. And that actually might be a good moment to kind of return from our broad discussion of, I suppose, the kind of quest for meaning, the problem of humans, humanity, and ideas about reason to the specific topic of politics and IR. So yeah, what is the kind of, as you notice in the book, the problem?
Well, the problem is, effectively,
it's human beings. Quite a nice problem.
Human beings. The big one. There's about 7 billion problems. They all coalesce into, and this is a big issue, because in the lectures on logic, which were finally written in 1800, written down, he starts to say, well, you know, the three big questions of Kant are, what can I know, what ought I to do, for what may I hope? And in the lectures on logic, he adds another, what is man, right? For him, from say 1790 onward, the question of man and the question of human beings and how they might be saved from themselves becomes a huge part of his writing, like from about 1789 to 1796, 7, when he starts to feel the effects of his mental decline. So how do you solve the problem of human beings? Well, funnily enough, what he does is he kind of combines the kind of pessimistic anthropology that he develops over time. And he says, well, okay, what happens if we allow human beings their head, if you like, and we just say, all right, human beings, how are you going to act for the foreseeable future? And he says, well, what do we find? We find all throughout history and all throughout our own experience that human beings are driven by what he calls, in the idea of universal history, unsocial sociability, which is the simultaneous attraction and repulsion of human beings to each other. Now, there's various psychological and natural drives that he identifies with this, as of esteem, or greed for power, etc. But he also says that human beings are rational and that they are self-seeking and calculating. And he thinks about the future and how that might manifest itself over time. And what he says is, it's going to be pretty much the same as it is now, except the stakes will get higher and higher and higher. And also running in parallel, business will develop, commerce will develop, and rational self-interest plus morally legislating ideas will converge. And it's kind of rational self-interest. People don't want to die, and people don't want to be poor. This will be the kind of motor of a sort of final crisis, whereby you might have a final war, which will either, as I said earlier, result in two options: either human beings put down the weapons and develop some kind of modus operandi for dealing with each other, or they will, as he says, find the perpetual peace of the graveyard, and that the species will die out, and with it all idea of right. And so what he starts to do is think, well, okay, how do we get to a point where we can put the weapons down And that's what the preliminary articles are all about. So he wants to have a final peace where there's no reservation of any future cause for war. There's no secret clauses. There's no secret diplomacy. It's a final decision of the warring parties for peace. And he says part of the parcel of this is that we have to get rid of standing armies. We have to stop using credit to finance wars because that just leads to the ever-increasing capacity of war making. We have to act in such a fashion as to make future peace possible. So if we are engaged in a war, not to use assassination, illegal means, etc., etc. So what he's trying to do is create a sort of legal framework for interaction between states in the future. And this, I think, was why he's so appealing to contemporary liberal thinkers, is because they think, oh, well, okay, here's Kant, and he's saying all these things about how we have access to a way of resolving war and creating peace. Up to a point, this is an interesting scenario because Kant is pointing towards what we can see happening over the last 200 years. We can see the development of international law. We can see the development of international organizations. But there's always something terrifying Kant, and that's the possibility of reversion, that we might create a working peace system based on rational self-interest. But there's always the threat that he associates with Moses Mendelssohn, that a society or civilization might start then to degenerate from the high point back into the state of war. So you wouldn't actually have achieved perpetual peace, you would have achieved a partial peace, a peace that's limited in space and time. What he wants to create is a peace that is not limited in space and time, but rather is, as he says, perpetual or eternal.
Which sets up quite nicely the entrance of God in terms of both, you know, the twist, as it were, in what we've been talking about is a set of, you know, practical legalistic frameworks, but the book, you know, is called, you know, the political theology. And obviously the kinds of, I suppose, modern legalistic IR frameworks, and to an extent, actually, the way cosmopolitanism has been interpreted in many, you know, social theoretical settings, really leaves out God and the theological. But the rest of the book, I mean, you know, it's in the at the start of the book as well, but the rest of the book is about bringing kind of God, I suppose, back in. So, you know, the really obvious question is, you know, how does God come into this, and why is, you know, this theological element so crucial to understanding what's actually going on in Kant's writings?
Yes, very good. Now, I should state at the outset that Kant never makes a claim that God exists. He's not about the existence of God. What he says is that if we want to access certain capacities for hope, we have to believe. In other words, there may or may not be a God, but we are required to believe that God exists. Right? So we don't make an ontological claim that there is a God and God has a design for human beings, and it basically the will of God will determine the outcomes of human fate or destiny. What he's saying is, right, we have no way of knowing that God exists, but we have to believe. Right? So it's the absence of knowledge that requires faith. And that faith is rooted in Kant's fear of nature itself. Right? Because, as I said earlier, nature can take you so far, but as he says in the Toward Perpetual Peace, he says, well, nature is not a kind and loving entity. Nature has its own ends, which we can't know. It may not have any ends. This is not open to us to know. We can give ourselves some purpose and some meaning to our existence if we extend beyond what we know in terms of what science reveals to us towards the idea of salvific faith, right? That the true soteriology, the study of salvation, will not lead us to nature, because nature doesn't really care about human beings. Human beings are simply a part of that mechanism. What we need is a whole different way of thinking about our relationships to each other and our relationship to existence in general. And that leads us to questions of, well, and it's the ultimate question as far as he's concerned, it's why should I behave morally? Why should I behave ethically in any given and certainly political circumstance? What's at stake, right? He says I'd have to be a fool to act according to rational morality if there were no God, if there were no afterlife, if I wasn't called to account for my, if you like, political sins, then I might as well just accept the mechanism of nature and act according to its rules. So as far as he's concerned, that way of thinking would lead us to the abyss. And we would inevitably fall into destruction if we did not believe in purpose of nature. And if we're going to have purpose of nature, then we have to have something behind purpose of nature as a sort of architect or legislator. And we have to think about that in terms of both providence and God. And that's why he says that even though we can never know God exists, we must always assume that he does. Because it's the only way then that we can act as if there is a purpose to nature. And then political purpose, the conclusion of which is to be hoped in perpetual peace, is found through this idea of purpose of nature, and that there is an author of nature, and that author has an eventual telos which mankind is capable of reaching. And we have to then orient ourselves to this set of beliefs, as opposed to what he sees as the kind of empty and ultimately destructive atheistic way of thinking about the world. As far as he's concerned, atheism is an absolute threat to any kind of effective political order, because it undercuts the basis of society, of a rational society, because it leaves us solely within the ambit, if you like, of politics. There would be no escape from the mechanism of nature for mankind in that scenario. So even though, as I said earlier, he doesn't insist that there is a God, he says if there were to be a God, it would be, and if we were to believe in a God, it gives us access to a whole range of possibilities and ways of living that we would not have via the atheistic denial of God. And there's a fascinating passage that I deal with at the end of the book, where he says that atheists, even good atheists, will find themselves cast into the abyss of nature. Because nature is indifferent to whether they are good as of and in themselves. And this is the defining aspect of nature, is its indifference. Whereas if we could believe that there was an entity that has created the universe and we are at the center of that creation, that gives us another way of orientation. And it's all about this idea of how we orient our political, social, rational, moral, ethical way of being in the world. do we do it by reference to nature, or do we do it by reference to providence?
Obviously, the big question that comes from that reorientation away from atheism towards a more theological mode of kind of thinking about IR is, what are the implications for our contemporary IR theorists? Then, you know, does this mean that, you know, much of, I guess, the kind of moment of going hand in hand with atheistic modernity and things like democracy, or, you know, things like rational law-based, rules-based approaches, essentially need to be rewritten, need to be, you know, thought again, because one of the key founding texts is much more theological than its, you know, kind of key proponents thought.
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. I think they're perfectly fine engaging in the Cosmopolitan project that they are engaged in. It's a fine project. But there are serious implications for how they go about it, right? Because what they haven't done is replaced the idea of God and providence with ideas of equivalent structural heft, if you like. They ignored the fact that providence and God and belief in the afterlife and all these theological and metaphysical ideas aren't just kind of addenda that you can ignore. They're actually at the very core of Kant's project. So if you're going to remove it or you're going to ignore it, then the question becomes, what are you going to replace it with? And this is a huge problem for contemporary Kantian cosmopolitans, because for Kant is, if you like, forced into these positions, because he's saying, well, how do I make the transition from how we appear to be in political terms to how we ought to be in moral terms? And he says, well, we can't do it by reference to ourselves. We can't do it by reference to human nature, because human nature produces these things on a consistent basis. Therefore, only belief can give us the capacity to move from how we are or appear to be to how we ought to be. Now, if you don't have belief, you're still stuck with this problem of, well, how do I get from is to ought? So if you look at someone like Thomas Pogge is very good at identifying the problem of contemporary global politics. Right? He's very clear that Western powers are self-seeking. They create the international structure of society according to their own interests. They are ruthless in the pursuit of those interests, and the consequence is the impoverishment and structural inequality that we see in terms of the distribution of resources, in terms of disease, in terms of exploitation, etc. So he outlines the problem. He also outlines a solution of human rights within a cosmopolitan and very, in some respects, Kantian frameworks for dealing with these problems. But what he can't do is say, well, okay, here's how we get from point A to point B, because he obviously doesn't take the metaphysics seriously. Right? He's someone who comes to Kant through John Rawls and reads Kant in those terms. Rawls is a bit embarrassed by the Kantian metaphysics, and he wants to just take the rules of Kant, if you like, that he finds in the Sekutique and in particularly in the groundwork, and say, well, let's just look at these and ignore this metaphysical context. Fine. But if you're going to do that, then you also need to come up with something that can bridge that gap. And I think the big problem that my book poses to people like Pogge and Thomas Bites and others is, well, okay, you've identified the problem, you've identified a solution, how do we get from problem to solution? And this is the advantage of Kant over contemporary Kantians and contemporary cosmopolitans. He has at least given a solution. Now, those of us who are less convinced by theological and metaphysical commitments that Kant embraces as the way out, if you like, or the solution to that process of moving from point A to point B, start to see the problem then in wider terms, in terms of, well, how do we think about international ethics and how do we think about international politics in a non-Kantian way? But it also poses the question to the Kantians and says, well, okay, over to you guys. How are you going to solve this real problem of that almost incommensurability between your identification of the problem and the solution? But the solution doesn't seem to lie in human beings in the way that seems to be almost understood by people like Poggi. And I think that's a big problem in terms of understanding what is possible and achievable in any given global political context.
The book has been really well received. You know, it's had a couple of awards. In terms of kind of answering that big question of, so what do we do? Is that going to be your next project? Or given the kind of, you know, positive reception of the book, is it a question of you've had quite enough of Kant and now something completely different?
I came to the project because I was also interested in what's called realist ethics in international relations. And I was thinking, why aren't realist ethics more significant in terms of how we think about international ethics and morality? And I thought, well, what's out there? What's preventing the emergence of this way of thinking about ethics? And I noticed that Kant was everywhere. Kant really does dominate how we think about the ethical sphere in and moral sphere in international relations. 90% of the discussions revolve around different variants of Kantian thought, maybe about 75%. But certainly a huge amount of the discussion revolves around Kant and the Kantian legacy. And I thought, well, I'm really going to have to deal with this Kant chat properly. Which is what then provoked me to go back and kind of work on these suspicions and kind of instincts that there was something peculiar about these invocations of providence. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll investigate. And the more I investigated, the more I thought, well, this is a very interesting project. I really have to deal with this in order to then say, okay, well, this is maybe why realist ethics needs to be looked at, because it offers a different set of alternatives. So what I'm doing next is a two-book project on realist ethics. So one set of realist ethics, sort of the I locate a constellation around the works of E.H. Carr, who is an atheist, right? He doesn't depend upon belief in God for his ways of thinking about ethics, right? So he embraces people like Marx, he embraces people like Spinoza, Machiavelli, and he's trying to work out a specifically political ethics. Right? What is possible within the political sphere in terms of ethical judgment and making decisions that have ethical implications? Right? So it's a very different way of thinking about moral possibility within the political sphere than Kant. And then after that, I'm going to do a book on Morgenthau. Morgenthau is somewhere between Carr and Kant, and he's much more interested in thinking about how to assess political behavior from a point outside politics informed by the moral law. Now, his idea of the moral law has certain similarities with Kant, but there's a lot of Aristotle, there's a lot of Weber, there's a lot of other kind of ways of thinking about ethics entailed in how Morgenthau wants to think about that relationship between politics and morality. And I think the advantage of doing this book first is that I know now how Kant conceives of politics as something that should, as he says in Toward Perpetual Peace, bend the knee toward morality. And this is the distinction between the moral politician and the political moralist. A moral politician will always make the moral law number one. But from a realist ethics point of view, that isn't the nature of politics itself. So I think we probably are better off trying to work out what is ethically possible within the political. So that's one aspect of where I'm going next with the ethical stuff. I'm also thinking of developing work along a book on David Hume, because I think a lot of the questions, the political questions that Kant is trying to develop answers to, revolve around his fear of Hume. And the big question for international relations and politics is, has Kant adequately answered the threat or challenge posed by Hume and the passions? And a lot of our kind of decision-making and theorization of politics has to really address this question, right? And it's something that Morgenthau raises in a great book from the 1940s called Scientific Man versus Power Politics. He says, the theorization of international politics has proceeded almost from the basis that David Hume never existed. So that challenge of Hume, that challenge of the Humean way of thinking, I think has to be restored to our way of thinking about international relations today. That perhaps Kant has obscured, Kant and the Kantian legacy has obscured another legacy that is very important to how we think about international relations, but which has only ever had a subterranean and a submerged and obscured articulation, and that's the Humean way of thinking about the world. So first I'll deal with the realist stuff, and then I'll deal with the Hume stuff. So, but the Kant element is key to both projects.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Sean Molloy about Kant's international relations, the political theology of perpetual peace.